This is, in a sense, a version of a speech that I've given for 20 years throughout my ministry in various places where I've served. And so it's something that's dear to my heart. And if I speak in a way that's inflammatory or radical or offensive to you, I hope you will challenge me, and I hope you will not take it personally, and I hope that I will sufficiently qualify and amplify what I'm saying to make it a little more understandable. Well, I want to tell you what my thesis is going to be, my argument with you today. Then I want to move on to what morphologically ails the church. Morphologically means shape, structure, institutional form. And then finally a proposal with 8 points. Okay, my thesis is going to be this, and this is where I'm going to stir up some dust right away. My thesis, and this is in a sense shop talk among people who are presumably interested and concerned, and maybe more than concerned, passionate about these matters. I regard, incidentally, the homework of the Christian church today, as in every day, every age, to be composed of these four C's: creed, code, cult, and constitution. Creed, that's theology. We have work to do in making theology and the doctrine and the teaching of the church accessible and understandable. Code, that's ethics, behavior, how we live out our life in Christ. And we got homework to do there. Lots of chairs here too. Cult, that's worship. That's been my chief interest, worship. How we respond to the love of God and what we do on Sunday morning or in our prayers, spiritual life, that kind of thing. But constitution is also part of our homework. That is to say, the structural, morphological shape, the institutional shape that the church takes. And that is what we're going to be considering the next 50 minutes, 60 minutes. So, my case is going to be this, and it consists of 4 points. First point, the automobile has done more than TV to ruin our common life. Simply, our life as citizens, not to mention our life as Christians. And it has certainly done a terrific damage to our cities and communities and neighborhoods. For all it's good, and I own an automobile, and I think it's terrific, and it does give us freedom, but that's part of the problem as well. The automobile has done more to ruin our cities and our lives than we have yet assessed, because it allows us to escape our problems at home. That's my first point. Then I'm going to say congregations ought to be defined at least partially by geographical considerations. That is to say, I would urge, and I'm going to urge under C, my proposal, a return to a sense of a geographical parish with geographical boundaries. And it's precisely because we have automobiles that we can escape those geographical boundaries that we're in the trouble that we're in today. And I'm going to argue that the church today is overfed and undernourished, and that church members, yourselves, are overworked and underemployed. We'll come back to that. And I'm arguing, still under number two here in my argument, that pastors and people should live within their geographical parish, determined by geographical boundaries. Where is home? Home is by the shopping center. And I'm going to argue number three, that our cities are doomed unless this is recovered. Our cities, our communities, our neighborhoods are doomed to further decay and further ruin unless Christian people and others too can recover a sense of neighborhood or a sense of community or a sense of what I will call geographical parish. And the church is unfaithful to its task if it does not begin to work on this aspect of its homework, if it does not begin to reclaim a sense of geographical parish. And finally, number four in my argument is going to be a call for a recovery of a sense of what I will call diocese. You could call it synod, you could call it district, you could call it conference, you could give it whatever name you want. I would call it diocese because that's an old traditional name within the church. And it means a sense of the church in this place. So, for instance, the church in presumably biblical days or immediate post-biblical days, the early centuries of the Christian church, there was the church at Jerusalem. Now, that may have been made up of several parishes or congregations, but it always thought of itself as the church at Jerusalem. Same with the church at Ephesus, the church at Corinth, the church at Rome. These were geographical entities, and the loyalty of the people within there was not so much to their congregation as to the city, the total community. And I'm going to argue that we should rethink congregational autonomy. The days of radical congregational autonomy have passed. I'm even going to argue that they have long since passed. And we must wake up to a new reality whereby congregations must join hands with other congregations and reclaim a sense of what I will call diocese. That is to say, several congregations, many congregations in a given geographical area, major metropolitan area, working together. I would even go so far as to say there should be no congregational decisions, no big decisions made at the congregational level, such as building a church, remodeling an existing church. No church should build. This is offensive, I realize it, and I'm willing to back away a little bit if you want to press me on it when we get to the time for dialogue. But I would say that no church, no single congregation has a right to decide it's going to build a building without getting the endorsement and the approval of other neighboring congregations. I would even say Holden Village does not have the right to reword the service book, the green service book, in favor of, let's say, less sexist language, without the endorsement and the approval of other congregations. As a matter of fact, I think they do that. They want to think of themselves in here in Holden Village as a kind of experimental laboratory for the whole church, and I think they should. But I think it should be more intentional. I think they should go to the bishop and go to the churches around and say, look, we want to be an experimental laboratory with inclusive language. Will you allow us? That kind of thing. Okay, that's going to be my argument. Now we're moving on to B. What morphologically ails the church? Morphos is shape or form or structure in the Greek, and morphologically means what ails the church institutionally or structurally. Well, there are a lot of things that ail the church, and I'm going to point out three of them. First of all, congregational autonomy, congregational independence, has long since outlived its usefulness, and it is run amok. In places such as Syracuse, where I spent 20 years of my ministry, and on a four-corner intersection downtown in the city of Syracuse, there were three Lutheran churches. All of the same synod, dear friends. I mean, it wasn't as if one was Missouri and one was ALC and one was LCA. They were all LCA churches. But way back, you know, 1840 or whatever, there was one church there, and then a group of members of that congregation got mad about something or other, the way the pastor parted his hair or whatever it was, and they broke off, and they formed another congregation, and they built a grander building across the street. Across the street. And it happened a second time. Another group disaffected, from which other congregation I forget, but they built a third building on a four-corner intersection. Now, I regard that as a scandal, and I hope you would regard that as a scandal, too. The primitive church, as I say, thought of itself as the church at Jerusalem. It was part of a sense of belonging to one another. This congregation belongs to this congregation, and they both of them belong to another congregation, and all together they are the church in Syracuse. And all together those dioceses are the church in North America. And all together those are the churches of the world. But we ought to recover and reclaim, this is my argument, a sense of all of us being brothers and sisters of one another. And that means congregations have, let us say, a limited usefulness and a limited expectation. Because that's going to be my second point in what morphologically ails the church. We are loading too much freight onto the congregation. The local parish, the local congregation, simply cannot do the job that we have assigned it to do today. And that's why church members are A, overworked, and B, underemployed. Now, congregations are too big for nurture, and they're too small for mission. That's going to be my point under number two here. J.T. Robinson, some of you may know him. He wrote
the liturgy coming to life, and he wrote Honest to God, and he wrote The Body, and other New Testament studies, a fine scholar, a bishop of the Church of England. He says, the most exciting ecumenical discovery in the 20th century has been the recovery of the cellular nature of the church. Let me unpack that for you. He says it's the most exciting ecumenical discovery has been a reclaiming, not a new thing, but a reclaiming of an old thing, namely the notion that the church is made up of cells and tissues and organs and limbs. St. Paul talks about it in the scriptures, but we haven't acted on it for a long time. And he maintains, and I would maintain with him, that there are appropriate levels of, may we even say technology, there's appropriate technology for the congregational level of church life, but we cannot expect that that level is going to do everything. The congregational level of church life is both too small for mission out in the world and too large for nurture. Example, case in point. A big congregation, even sometimes smaller congregations these days, frequently have two services on Sunday. The 9:30 people do not know the 11 o'clock people. There is no sense of community there. That congregation is too big to do the job of nurturing the faith of the faithful. What's the solution? Well, don't disband the congregation. Congregation is a great organization, but within the congregation, we're going to have to provide for cell groups or base communities or koinonia groups or cottage meetings. Or do some of you have experience with that? Raise your hand if you know a church, or maybe you're part of a church with cell groups or koinonia groups. That's where nurture happens, at that small level. 8 people, 12 people, no more than 12 people, I don't think. 20 may be too big. But it's in those kind of small groups where we can tell our story to one another and where my faith is nurtured and your faith is nurtured. It does not happen at 9:30 or 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Other good things happen then, but not that, for the most part. Furthermore, still on a number 2 here, the congregation is too small for mission. That is to say, to address the problems of its community, the congregation is too weak, too small, too powerless. You cannot fight City Hall and get the garbage collected on your street if you're just one congregation. If you're 12 or 13 congregations, you can. That's why I'm arguing for a sense of diocese. Congregations cooperating together at, let me say, the macro level. I talked a minute ago about the micro level. Here's the congregational level. Okay, the micro level would be cell groups, koinonia groups, cottage meetings, base communities, whatever you want to call them. But not only that, you got to get bigger too. And congregations have to join with each other to fight City Hall. Or to do evangelism. Or to do any one of a lot of different jobs I could think of. I proposed this first 20 years ago to the churches in our area where we lived at Syracuse, New York. And there were 13, 14 churches involved, downtown churches, churches near the ghetto, beautiful suburb to the west, another beautiful suburb to the north, absolutely gorgeous, exclusive suburb to the east. All of those congregations joining together, we met regularly, and I proposed this to them. I said, wouldn't it be great if we could cooperate and we could do a little sharing? And one of my brother pastors was excited by the possibility, and he looked into, for instance, just the possibility of buying paper supplies, 8.5 by 11 mimeo bond. And he said, if the congregations in the Syracuse area did nothing but join their finances to purchase common paper supplies for all the parishes, they could save hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Now, they didn't do it. But my argument is, ain't it a shame? I mean, couldn't we begin to trust one another? When I was a campus pastor, I began right from the beginning in my ministry as a campus pastor having a Sunday service. And some of the local parishes weren't always aware of that or conscious of it, or if they wanted to be conscious of it, they maybe were a little threatened by it. Anyhow, I'd get a call every now and then from a local parish pastor, and he'd say, hey, can you send over a couple of students to sing in my choir on Sunday morning? And it used to get me mad. But then I thought, well, why not? And I used to answer him, instead of getting mad, I'd say, sure, I'll send over a couple of students to sing in your choir. How about you sending down a couple of adults to help teach my Sunday school? I mean, we ought to have that sense, right? That I scratch your back, you scratch mine, more than that. That we are the body of Christ together here in the city of Syracuse. Okay, the congregation is too big for nurture. It's too small for mission. It can do other things wonderfully, and among them raise money. the small groups don't, you know, they're not very efficient for raising money. But the cellular nature of the church ought to be respected and taken advantage of. May I say that the congregation is not the only structure. There are camps. There's Holden Village. There's the military chaplaincy. There's hospital chaplaincies. There's campus ministry. I mean, all of these are different cells of the body, each of them doing a distinctively different kind of job, and each of them legitimate, I think. And can we have a sense that one is working on behalf of the other, for the other, that we're all in this together? We're not competing. So often local congregations become competing fiefdoms. Isn't that so? You know, the local parish pastor, if he's got some pizzazz or some kind of charisma, begins to enlarge the boundaries of the church one way or another, emotionally or intellectually or whatever, if not actually geographically. And we begin to think of each other as competitors instead of as co-workers. Finally, the medieval parish, a call for a reclaiming of the medieval parish. In the Middle Ages, as you may know, there was a sense, presumably, of geographical parish, that every parish church had distinct geographical boundaries, some more distinct than others, but there was a sense in which that parish then had the cure of souls within that parish. It had the care of all those people in that parish, within the shadow of that church's spire. Wonderful possibility. We lived in England for a while, and I was the pastor of a kind of refugee church in Leeds in the north country of England, big industrial city, dirty industrial city. Marvelous people, however, I should say, the British, and also these ethnic refugees. They were largely Baltics, Estonians, Latvians, that kind of thing, Norwegians, Swedes, and so on, who had fled during the war, during Second World War, to England and had married English spouses and were raising English families now, but they still had ties with their old country and the old homeland. I don't think anything's wrong with that. But I was sent temporarily as the pastor to this little congregation. And every day, when we had our breakfast, we could see the local Anglican priest walking down the alley behind our house in his cassock, would you believe, to go to the Anglican church and have office hours or whatever. And we attended that church on a couple of occasions. It was a wonderful place. It was a great big old neo-Gothic barn of a building. I won't say it was packed on Sunday morning, but it certainly had a respectable congregation, not like a lot of European churches, which are, you know, half empty. This was by no means half empty. And it was full of rich and poor, black and white. It was a very mixed neighborhood where we lived, Pakistanis, Muslims, and so on. Anyhow, here was rich and poor, black and white, old and young, all of them. It was a wonderful service. And in talking with the parish priest of this Church of England church, it became clear to me that I was part of his parish. And he had responsibility for me. And at first I was offended by, we're Lutheran, we're not Anglican. But then I began to think, how nice that there's somebody here who worries about us besides me. And that guy even had the sense that he was concerned about the Muslims who lived within the shadow of his spire. He had the old sense of a geographical parish. This is my parish, and I have responsibility for everybody there. Christians and non-Christians alike. Church of England or whoever. Okay, it's that kind of thing that I see being reclaimed. And the medieval parish is the last place where people lived, worked, slept, played, and worshipped, dear friends, all in the same geographical location. And it's great. And may I say that a residential campus such as the one I serve is the very last place. I mean, here you have students, dormitories, right? They sleep in the dormitories, they play in the playing fields and in the gym. They eat in the dining halls. They work and study in the laboratories and in the classrooms. And they worship in my chapel. It's a medieval parish. And it's the last place on earth where you can find it. Because so many of our parishes, you know, they're commuter clubs. They're not parishes anymore. You drive past two other Lutheran churches to get to the club of your choice. Now, there's something wrong there. I can't blame you. I mean, again, I want to be sympathetic to you. But there's something wrong there. We ought to reclaim a sense. You may know the inner city, what do they call it? The Center City Parish in Philadelphia. There is a congregation, a congregation of congregations in downtown Philadelphia. I think there's something like 20 churches that have represented a revival of Lutheran church life, anyhow, in downtown Philadelphia. Philadelphia is big Lutheran territory, as you may know, all of Pennsylvania. Big Lutheran territory, not quite as big as Minnesota, but big in the East, anyhow. And for a long, long time, the inner city churches in Philadelphia were just dying. And then along came a hotshot pastor who pulled all these congregations together. You said, you want to live? Okay, let's make up some rules. They made up some rules. They began to work together. They began to see each other as co-workers instead of as competitors for scalps and for money and for talent and for time. They began to see each other as co-workers. And one of the rules they developed was this. The pastor always wears a clerical collar. I mean, that's rough stuff in downtown Philadelphia, let me tell you. And the pastor is always immediately identifiable. And B, the pastor has to live in the parish. Well, the people don't take him seriously, right? He commutes from New Jersey to serve. That's what happens in New York City. There's a famous church that I will not mention in New York City, a big Lutheran church, a big famous Lutheran church in New York City, where the pastor, at least a couple years ago, lived in New Jersey and commuted in on Sundays. That does not seem to me to be the way to reclaim and to renew our neighborhoods. If I live and work and sleep and play and worship in the same neighborhood, I'm committed to it. I gotta make it happen. I can't escape it with my automobile. Okay, what's my proposal? Then I'll have you get a chance to speak. 8 points. 1, I would like to see geographical parishes within what I have called a diocese. And the diocese is centered in every major metropolitan area. The suburbs and the exurbs and the rural areas have to be attached to the major metropolitan areas, and the question you ask is simply, where do you shop? I mean, if you live way on a farm in North Dakota, where do you go to do your shopping? Minot, Grand Forks, I mean, you know, people know those things. If you go to Minot to shop, then you're in the Minot Diocese. If you go to Grand Forks to shop, you're in the Grand Forks Diocese, that kind of thing. 2, major decisions are made at the diocese level. Congregations still have a role, and they still ought to have some kind of structure, church councils or whatever, but I would see major decisions being made at the level of diocese. That is to say, there be a diocese-wide committee on evangelism, a diocese-wide committee on church mission, a diocese-wide committee on social action, or justice for the poor, or collecting the garbage in the city streets, or whatever. A diocese-wide worship and arts committee. My goodness, what could you do with the arts if you had all this talent, this pool of people to draw from? It would be marvelous. Anyhow, all of that kind of stuff at the diocese level. Besides that, 3, we would have within each congregation cell groups or koinonia groups or nurture groups or base communities or whatever you want to call them, people who tell each other their stories and who nurture each other in faith. That has to happen at a smaller level. I mean, there have to be 12 or 15 people at the most, I would say, in those kinds of groups. But we ought to encourage their growth. 4, I would say, yes, the pastor should live in the parish. 5, I would say the people should be strongly encouraged to live in the parish. Or, if they're living already in one place, to change their membership to the parish that's near them. Now, that's going to be very tricky. I don't see how you can possibly compel people to do that. Roman Catholics presumably have this system, but it doesn't work for them either. It hasn't worked very well since the Middle Ages. And maybe the Middle Ages, that the medieval parish, and the kind of thing I have on the campus where I serve, is not just a freak or a bygone, you know, relic of a past age, but maybe it's going to be thrust upon us with the fossil fuel, you know, the depletion of the fossil fuels. I mean, maybe our cars are just going to rust in their driveways one of these days because we can't get fuel to fuel them. And we'll have to depend on public transportation in other ways. In any case, I think we ought somehow to strongly encourage people to live in their parish, their geographical parish. Number six, am I moving on correctly? Yeah, six, I see one cathedral church in each parish. And again, this is going to be a tricky one because the big church downtown probably has a neighboring big church that wants to compete for the same honor. But we ought to sort that out somehow. I suppose a place like Minneapolis might be able to have a couple of dioceses and a couple of cathedrals. But I see a cathedral church as being, frankly, non-geographic. I see that as welcoming strangers and welcoming maybe disaffected people from parishes who do want to drive past six or seven others to get to the cathedral. I don't see how you can prevent that. But only one in a major metropolitan area. Or if you can arrange the metropolitan area in such a way geographically, two or three, again, a place like Minneapolis, St. Paul, you could probably do it. And that's the level at the cathedral where you see the arts flourishing, a fabulous educational program, a fabulous social justice program, a fabulous evangelism program, those kind of things. The cathedral being the model for other smaller churches. Number seven. Legitimize and make the most of specialized short-term congregations, such as military chaplaincy, camps and outdoor ministry, university and college ministries such as my own, hospital chaplaincies and ministries, Holden Village-type retreat centers. I mean, these are all parts of the body of Christ. These are all different cells or organs or tissues or members or joints or whatever of one body. And let's make the most of them. Let's say that Holden Village is an experimental laboratory for certain things, like experimenting with sexist language. And let that be regularized throughout the church. Let there be other places that are experimental laboratories for this or that. Wonderful. A sense then that you do your thing for me. I don't have to do it. I do my thing for you. You don't have to do it. Those specialized ministries are already with us. We should simply legitimize them. Make the most of them. Finally, eight. This is not a prescription for church growth. You may have heard of the church growth movement. Maybe some of you are devoted to it. I think this represents a challenge to the church growth movement. The church growth movement says, among other things, no kids in church. No children. They disrupt. Another thing, every congregation should seek an identity of its own, white, middle class, whatever, and stick with it. Don't invite anyone outside that group. That's what the church growth movement says. If you want your church to grow, find an identity, stick with it, don't invite anyone else. If your congregation is white, middle class, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, make sure that it stays that way. Don't invite any blacks or Chicanos or anyone else. If your church is black, don't invite any honkies, just blacks. Your church will grow. I think it will grow. I mean, that's the terrible part of it. I think the church will grow. But is that the body of Christ? Not the body of Christ that I want. So, number eight, this is not a prescription for church growth. I do not think the church will grow. I think it will suffer. But I think it will suffer for the right reasons. And the church now is suffering anyhow. That's my argument. The church now is suffering anyhow. And it will be suffering for the right reasons. I think the church today, as I say, is overfed and undernourished, and its members are overworked and underemployed. Well, my proposal, not just mine, I didn't invent this, I just got it from a lot of different sources. My proposal hopes to put us to work in the right thing. Why are congregational members burned out? Because what they do, they perceive as busy work, or it isn't going to give any results. I'm not saying you can get greater results doing this, but I'll bet you do. And that's, I think, where the action is. Okay, fight back with me. That's the end of my speech. Go ahead, discuss.
It's not clear to me what happens with the three churches on three of the four corners, yeah, when it would seem that working together could well mean not maintaining three separate facilities and all the resources that requires, not necessarily maintaining three separate full-time pastors.
The end of the story, which I didn't tell you, is that they're all gone. Two of them merged with the third, and then both of them merged with the other one, and then they both merged with the suburban church. And they're downtown, and the downtown church, the downtown is now empty. Downtown Syracuse is now empty of Lutheran churches. Hand over here, and then hand over here.
How do you address the question of the sort of shopping around for the right church, yeah, for your family? You mentioned the thing that, you know, the automobile is the kind of thing where you can kind of go and shop around. I know that I grew up in one church. When I got married and had children, that church was an inner city church, sort of failing to meet the needs of youth, and we shopped around.
Sure, sure.
Okay? So we drove by six churches on the way to the church that we go to now. There's, yeah, a church which is a block away from our house. Mm-hmm. And we go, yeah, 6 miles to a church. How do you address that question?
I can hardly blame you, because, you know, I would do the same thing. And say, I have to confess that I would probably do the same thing. But
just a quick point to go along with that. We went to that church half block away. The pastor was not dynamic. The, yeah, programs were not dynamic.
That's the people weren't friendly, yeah.
Well, the people were beautiful people. Oh. They were really friendly. The pastor just didn't, you know, have what we wanted. The program wasn't there. So we, yeah, went to a church we were really comfortable with.
Anybody got a good answer to
it? How do you address that?
I guess all I want to do is give you a guilty conscience, yeah, about it. You know,
I have one.
Is that the way it's supposed to be? I mean, wouldn't there be a better way? Anyone got a better answer for him? Do you have
an
answer?
I don't have a better answer, but I think it's real societal. I mean, why, yeah, should it be any different in church than it is to your local department store, if that's how we see churches?
Do you see a church, though, as a kind of a shopping mall or a...
Well, that's how it's perceived. If,
yeah,
you
but
don't
should
understand
it be?
The church as the caring community,
no,
and that community that supports you in all those kinds of needs, but if you see it as a church that, you know, that has flamboyant programs or a flashy pastor for 5 years, and then what happens if he leaves?
Yeah,
then he goes somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, that happens all the time.
You know, and
it?
So I guess it's all in society's perceptions of what the church is.
Mm-hmm. You'd agree with me that there's a problem there, right?
Sure.
Yeah. There was a hand over here. Kathy?
Well, what if, in this situation with the gentleman, you went to the pastor and said, I live in the shadow of this church, and I would really like this to be my home parish. However, I feel I have these needs for the faith development of my family. What is there that we can do to enrich the programs that we have so it meets our needs?
Yeah. Now that would
maybe the pastor is saying, gee, you know, I'd really like to do some of this, but nobody else is interested. People just may not be talking. What are their intentions or their wants, or
you're pointing out that maybe Christians have a responsibility to stay in an unlikely or uncongenial setting and tough it out and try to make it better.
Well, that may be one of the responsibilities.
We're calling to that, yeah. Go ahead.
Your idea of having a half a dozen or more churches in a diocese, is this a cross section of various denominations, Catholics, Lutherans?
My vision would include, would be ultimately ecumenical, yes. And there might be situations where we say, well, Anglicans, you're already established down here in the southeast part of the city. Us Lutherans are not going to move in there because the Anglicans are, you know, they got a going thing there. And I would hope we would do all these kind of things with an ecumenical vision. Lutherans are not the only ones who have the gospel. But I'm chiefly thinking in terms of getting our Lutheran house in order right now. And I don't see it just six or seven. I see it all the churches in a major metropolitan area. But there's an optimum size. Again, I'm no demographer or sociologist. We'd have to go to the sociologist and say, what's the optimum size for what I'm calling a diocese? I do not think, as I understand the documents and I understand the plans, I do not think that the synods of the new ELCA are dioceses. in my sense of the term, are they?
No.
They're not. Ain't it a pity? I mean, don't you wish they were? Or don't you? Now, you don't wish they were.
Well, I don't think it's the problem with having that many synods is you'd have that many bishops.
More employment.
Can you imagine 300 bishops? That's a lot of miters. That's just...
Well, down at the next level.
Well, I mean, there are conferences and stuff, and I think those could function in that way.
Uh-huh. And maybe there should be an archbishop. You know, Minneapolis might be big enough to have a diocese of dioceses. For whatever it's worth, let me just give you this statistic. We have a friend who's a social worker in New York City. He says his caseload is 80 people. Now, I don't know what it is in other cities. Maybe some of you are MSWs and know, but I mean, what's the caseload of a typical pastor? What's the caseload of a typical bishop with parishes? You know, boy, we got to do some thinking here. Go ahead.
I come from a community of about 10,000 people that have been there's five churches that have been experimenting with that ecumenical thing that you're talking about for about the last 8-9 years, and it's been really successful. It's been really supported well by the community. There's a Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopalian, I can't remember what the other church is. But those five particular ones have worked together. They have a kind of a board that meets and that among their people with their pastors, and they make an effort of about, six times a year or so that there's certain things that those particular churches sponsor together, and they do certain things mm-hmm. together, and it has really been a successful thing, mm-hmm. and it has really brought the community together.
Perfect. You make a spark in my head. When I was in Syracuse, we got these congregations, these 13 Syracuse congregations, including the suburbs, together for a confirmation service. All the kids that year were confirmed by the bishop. Mm-hmm. In one of the churches. It was a marvelous service, and I think they've continued that tradition, as a matter of fact. Another point, comment. Go ahead, Mark.
I think the vision is somewhat romantic. In the medieval, the whole notion of the medieval parish, but I don't think we live in neighborhoods.
Ain't it a pity?
Well, that may be a pity, but the reality is that we don't. One of my goals is to have the people who live in the suburban community I do realize that they relate and, in fact, gain most of their services from the urban inner city, whether it's the arts or whether it's the zoo or whether it's... And if we were to foster only to understand our ministry, only in terms of those things that were in the shadow of our spire, we would, in fact, be segmenting a community that we are seeking to, need to seek to try to make whole.
Mm-hmm. That's why I say the cellular nature of the church. We have to have structures that are smaller than the congregation. We have to have structures that are larger than the congregation, where there is true loyalty and true commitment. That congregations feel committed to each other, and the suburban congregation feels committed to that downtown black ghetto congregation, and vice versa.
I think one of the places is to be committed to a quality of life in the community that you're working in. That is part of the church's mission, and probably it's not one of the things we've understood as part of our mission.
Mm-hmm.
We've thought about it as a quality of life of individuals or getting to heaven or those kinds of things. But mm-hmm. I think what I've been pleading for the last couple of weeks here is a sense in which parishes are renewed when they are concerned about the quality of life in their communities. And I think that might be the place where then... If that is true, maybe the church is down the street from me is really doing a wonderful job with Elder Hostel and doing a whole lot of stuff with that. I have young children. I need to go but maybe we can still see that that's part of the mission and part, even though I pass them, I don't feel guilty. I might even support them, and I might even sometimes volunteer at the Elder Hostel.
Great, great.
But
you're not far from the kingdom. I mean, no, your vision is not too different from my vision then.
But I think that just in terms of the shadow of the spire may, in fact,
do just the opposite of what you mm-hmm. want and plead to do. It may make us more parochial.
Yeah. Well, I hope I've qualified that with the sense of diocese or the sense of the church in the geographical area.
Just an observation. We moved from a community of 50,000 with a congregation of 2,700 to a community of 1,700 with a parish of 300.
Culture shock.
Yeah. But I see much more of the medieval church in the rural community.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everything you labeled there, except the connection to the larger diocese,
mm-hmm.
we're
Great.
Experiencing. I mean, Great. It's geographical out of necessity.
Sure.
There's cooperation with the Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church with Dynamite. Sunday school, and we live in the parish because yeah. that's the only place to live. So the rural areas, at least from what I'm seeing, are still there.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody's beating down the door to say, hey, we'd like to use you as an example.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think they've got a lot to teach us. Don't you think they got something to teach us?
Mm-hmm.
I think they do. Mm-hmm. And how many pastors are here, and how many have pastoral meetings like a collegiate, a sense of collegiality among the pastors?
Boise, Idaho has clusters.
Say it again, in clusters?
Boise, Idaho has clusters.
Do they meet regularly and yeah. have a sense that I belong Tuesday to you morning. And you belong to me?
Every Tuesday morning? Yeah. It's regular.
Great. Wonderful. Studying the Bible together. Boy, we did that in Syracuse. Wonderful. Go ahead, another one.
Are you talking about interdenominational?
Sure.
They've been doing that in Portland quite a while, too.
Mm-hmm. Interdenominationally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Clusters of different denominations.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great if all the church musicians in a city could get together every now and then and feel that they were all working on the same thing with the same energies and so on?
I have the opposite experience from you in that I lived in a relatively small community, 15,000, a parish of 400, and moved to a much larger community and a smaller parish.
Mm-hmm.
And I had also experienced in my previous location that sense of what we're talking about here, church and diocese. I mean, the community was very much committed to working together. But in the larger metropolitan setting, the sense of competition is incredible.
It's incredible, mm-hmm. it is.
And the clergy that I work with, I don't trust half of them.
See, you know,
they're out for your scalps and your members.
That was our observation too, is that there were too many egos.
Yeah.
You know, and very much in that, you know, when I was seeing in the discussion this morning about male issues, seeing competition and all of those qualities.
The power and the control, yeah.
Much more of that in the urban church.
But I also think there's a reason for it, and it is because of congregational autonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea that that
every little congregation is its own little kingdom
and is competing
with
another little kingdom down the way. And if we can only develop a better youth program, we'll get in more families instead of working together.
Yeah. That book, me.
Don't you regret that?
Oh, yeah.
Is there anybody here who does not regret that? I mean, that isn't the way it should be. Bill, and then...
I just was going to say that hooked me because I went to the one with the better program.
But, you know, go ahead.
But my response when you were talking...
And you.
Excuse me for butting in, but... when you were talking earlier, that really hooked me too, because mm-hmm. I had not too long ago had an experience with a family that did that very same thing. We do not have a youth program, a dynamic youth program. We don't attract those families with older or even younger children. And they told me flat out that they were going to be looking elsewhere. And my appeal to them was, if we had more people that had that sense of what you're expressing, we would begin attracting them.
And I hear Mark suggesting, if I can still butt in here, that maybe a church, a given parish, could have as a specialty old folks, let's say. And another one could have as a specialty youth ministry, and people from other parishes could send their, without a sense of losing them, without a sense of competition, send their kids to that youth program. you know.
I do agree the congregational autonomy gets in the way of that.
Say it again?
I agree that radical congregational autonomy is a problem.
Darn right.
And it does get in the way of that kind of cooperation, which is very, very difficult.
And we learn it at seminary. I mean, pastors learn to be entrepreneurs at seminary, unfortunately. Here, and then way back.
Well, I was just going to say that I feel like a lot of the problem has been that just we have lost sight of what the real definition of the church is all about. Like what you were saying before, it's that nuclear family part of it, that how it's supposed to work together, the sense of community that you were talking about. I think it's really important that a congregation have all ages within it, because you know, there's things that those of us that are younger as families need to draw from the ones that have already been through it.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, all of that has to fit together, and we've lost sight of that. And so instead, we're looking around instead for something that fits our needs, because it's not there.
Mm-hmm. Example, I have a very hothouse congregation. I have a student congregation. Almost everybody there is between the age 17 and 30. And I'm having a thought this year. I have members on my board, you know, that support and direct my ministry. And I have other friends out in the city, including friends of our faculty and administrators at the schools I serve. And I think I may be inclined, anyhow, I'm going to mull this over in the next month, to approach some of them and say, look, on a regular schedule, can I have one of you come with your family to our service on Sunday morning, the first Sunday of this month, and somebody else the second Sunday of the month, and so on, just so that my students see some gray hairs and also some little kids, because we don't have any little kids. I mean, they need that. And I would even say, if they're not there, we ought to invent them. I mean, we ought to phrase our prayers and pretend that they're there. Go ahead.
Well, we have three LCA churches in the community where I live. And we have joint Bible study together. We have social programs together. And when the confirmation youth, they lots of time have gone on their retreats together from the churches. And I think this has been really a great
works
thing
to get,
for
works
the three
good.
Churches. Mm-hmm. Yes, it really works well. And we have gotten to know the people from the other churches. And the community where I live, and they call it a bedroom community, because everybody works in Seattle or Tacoma or Bellevue or someplace. And so this has given more of a sense of community, the three churches working together, than I think anything they've ever had in that area.
Great. The Lord, hold up your hands.
And pastors have a very good ecumenical program between themselves, too. And
excellent.
So it's been really working.
I just wonder if the Lutheran churches are going to take advantage of the fact that we had a merger, or is it going to continue in the past as it has? Instead of having clusters, as they mentioned in Boise, we have cliques.
These are the Norwegians and these are the Swedes.
And how can we accomplish anything with that?
It's something you weep over. I mean, it shouldn't be. Wouldn't you agree with me?
Yeah. It's sad.
And there are ways of overcoming it. I mean, there really are. But you have to devote yourself to it, commit yourself to it, work with a small group, work with those who are willing to work. When we began our confirmation thing in Syracuse, there were only a few churches that wanted to go in on it. They thought it was too risky. But as the plans developed, boy, more and more thought, gee, this sounds like a great idea. And I think we ended with almost all of the churches having their kids confirmed in one service, where all the families, and they had a supper that night. I mean, it was a big festival. It was lovely. Go ahead, and then here.
I'm still struggling with driving by that church.
Boy, I really made a guilt trip on him. Oh, poor guy. Oh, oh dear. I absolve you.
I'll tell you why. I'm really struggling with that question, because I'm asking myself the question constantly, why do I go to church? And I think every one of us in here, you have to ask yourself, why do you go to church? Do you go to church because your neighbor goes to church, or he gets up? Or do you go to church, get up on Sunday morning and all dressed up, your neighbor's going golfing, and you very smugly get in your car, and you say, I'm going to church, and I'm the pious guy on the block. Why in the hell do you go to church? And I'm struggling with that question right now. Excuse my language, but I struggle with it, because I go to church because I want to have a relationship with my God. And I don't care who, if I'm the only person who's in that church, I don't care. I want to go to that church because I want to get something out of that on Sunday morning. I want to go home enlightened. I want to go home and talk about what happened. I want my kids to go to that daggone Sunday school to come home with those knitted things in the Narnia house. I want something out of that darn church. Besides that, I'm paying $50 a Sunday.
We'll take it out, church.
I hope this is all on tape. Marvelous.
On the other hand,
isn't it important?
But I want people to go for the same reason.
For the right reasons.
I go to church,
right.
You know?
Right.
So if I have to drive by six churches to go to that church that I want to go to, and I can go down to the church a half a block down the road and say, yeah. You know, and I could be the guy that didn't go golfing on Sunday, and I went to, and I didn't get diddly squid out of it. I want to go to church because something moved me, something calls me to that church. And, you know, I'm sorry, but
good enough reason.
Lutherans really lose sight of that sometimes. I really feel they do. People go to church because everybody else goes to church. Oh, Lord.
Now, if his pastor moves from that church and the program changes, are you going to continue going to that church because you really want to go?
That's why I'm struggling. That's why I'm struggling. See, that's why I'm willing to drive by six churches to go to a church that I want to get something out of.
Yeah, you can't be blamed for that at all, I don't think.
This guy's going to be a tough act to follow.
What do you do for an encore?
In our church, we have what we call an outreach committee. About six or eight of us, myself included, go out and make calls on the people that are shut in, having problems, haven't been in church for a while. I'm trying to visualize myself calling on some Presbyterian family and saying, I'm from Faith Lutheran Church in the other side of town.
Yeah.
And yet, all of a sudden, it feels good. If I were to go to that Catholic family and say, our pastor has heard from your priest, and I understand that you've got a death in the family that's giving you problems. So we came here to see if we could be of any consolation.
Caring
feel bad at all.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Boy.
It sounds feasible.
It can happen.
If not decent.
Great. Marvelous. Yes, go ahead, Bill.
I'm still trying to understand how your model might work with the problem of the dying downtown churches where nobody lives within the shadow of the steeple. I was at a church for a number of years. Where
just warehouses or factories or...
Well, the parish worker knocked on every door, rang every doorbell within walking distance of the church, and there was no response there. Hardly anybody lived less than 20 minutes away. Yeah. Do you then go build another building out in the suburbs near where there are more people living?
Maybe. That has been our pattern, has it not? For 30, 40 years, that's been our pattern. Mm-hmm. But again, I would argue, on the basis of my model, that should be a decision made at the super congregational level,
right,
not the congregational level. No congregation has a business making that decision by itself.
And the one thing your model would do that is helpful is it is likely that the cathedral would remain downtown.
Yeah, right. I think it should be downtown. Absolutely.
And there's probably already the
building. And there's probably some big barn of a church downtown already.
Desperately in need of a new roof.
Yes. Right. We're going to have to quit in a minute. Go ahead.
Maybe I'm not clear, Paul, on your upper level, but... would you agree that a community is enriched, a true community is enriched by a diversity of people?
Oh, absolutely.
And it just seems like if you're arguing that a small community or a small number is necessary for that community interaction, if you're setting geographic boundaries, it just seems like there's going to be a strong difficulty to get that diversity unless it's at that upper level that you're describing and you lose the small numbers there.
Yeah. I see a congregation made up of a whole lot of little cells koinonia groups, whatever you want to call it, and then a whole bunch of these together, you know, making, you know, what I'm calling a diocese, a major metropolitan area. So you got three levels, at least three levels, and when you, you know, you go beyond that to the national level or maybe the regional. You got the level of the little small group where the nurture takes place, and I feed your faith and you feed mine by we telling our stories. Then you got the congregational level, which has its own proper work. Then you've got the big diocese or the community or the city or the major metropolitan area or whatever you want to call it, where I think mission happens. That is to say, serving the world.
But you won't find your diversity until the third level.
Well. Yeah, there can be a certain amount of diversity in a congregation, and even in the little cell group, perhaps, depending upon your location, perhaps. And maybe you want to import a few, you know. That may not be so crazy.
To what?
Import. From another section, just for the sake of enriching.
Then you're commuting.
Then you're commuting, yeah, but with a difference. I think there's a difference. Go ahead. Hang on. Here. Go ahead.
Well, you haven't really defined that there, and I'm wondering, my question is on these cell group things. I know of a couple of large churches in a couple of big cities that they're real spread out all over the people are, but the one thing for their cell group things is that they have to be, those people have to be in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, or?
Yeah, I mean, this is all in the process of being formed.
That would be the ideal. But,
you know, let's try it, sure.
That, okay.
Where was the other? I guess it was.
Somebody said busing, and I wanted to pick up on that because I've been thinking about that ever since you started talking. One of the reasons for busing was that if the white children were bused downtown to the black school, which is what was going on over in Tacoma and around, the parents followed, and it became a good school for PTA. Black parents became educated in what we've been doing for years and years that they had never seen, didn't even know how the PTA worked or anything. And so the parents follow their children, and good things happened.
It worked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice witness. Go ahead.
We come from a predominantly Mormon community. Their structure is a ward. And when the ward gets to be, what is it, a little more than 300? Something like that. Members, the ward divides.
Huh. Like an amoeba.
Yeah. So there are other wards. But they have a cross-section, seems to me, when we look at it, there's about 200,000 people in Ada County, and there are probably between 50 and 60, maybe more than that, Mormon churches in that 200,000. So they do have a diversity of economic groups in that small community. Then so many wards, and I don't know how wards, become the stake, a hierarchy or a part of this community. Then from there comes the temple. It seems to work because they're sure growing.
Yeah, well, maybe they got something to teach us.